going out to see what I can find, Jack said.
I'll come with you, Mary said. Carl watched them walk to the kitchen. He settled back against the cushion and watched them walk. Then he leaned forward very slowly. He squinted. He saw Jack reach up to a shelf in the cupboard. He saw Mary move against Jack from behind and put her arms around his waist.
Are you guys serious? Helen said.
Very serious, Carl said.
About Alaska,
Helen said. He stared at her.
I thought you said something, Helen said.
Jack and Mary came back. Jack carried a large bag of M&Ms and a bottle of cream soda. Mary sucked on an orange popsicle.
Anybody want a sandwich? Helen said. We have sandwich stuff.
Isn't it funny? Mary said. You start with the desserts first and then you move on to the main course.
It's funny, Carl said.
Are you being sarcastic, honey? Mary said.
Who wants cream soda? Jack said. A round of cream soda coming up.
Carl held his glass out and Jack poured it full. Carl set the glass on the coffee table, but the coffee table smacked it off and the soda poured onto his shoe.
God damn it, Carl said. How do you like that? I spilled it on my shoe.
Helen, do we have a towel? Get Carl a towel, Jack said.
Those were new shoes, Mary said.
He just got them.
They look comfortable, Helen said a long time later and handed Carl a towel.
That's what I told him, Mary said.
Carl took the shoe off and rubbed the leather with the towel.
It's done for, he said. That cream soda will never come out.
Mary and Jack and Helen laughed.
That reminds me, I read something in the paper, Helen said.
She pushed on the tip of her nose with a finger and narrowed her eyes.
I can't remember what it was now, she said.
Carl worked the shoe back on. He put both feet under the lamp and looked at the shoes together.
What did you read? Jack said.
What? Helen said.
You said you read something in the paper, Jack said.
Helen laughed.
I was just thinking about Alaska, and I remembered them finding a prehistoric man in a block of ice. Something reminded me.
That wasn't in Alaska, Jack said.
Maybe it wasn't, but it reminded me of it, Helen said.
What about Alaska, you guys?
Jack said.
There's nothing in Alaska, Carl said.
He's on a bummer, Mary said.
What do you guys do in Alaska?
Jack said.
There's nothing to do in Alaska,
Carl said. He put his feet under the coffee table. Then he moved them out under the light once more.
Who wants a new pair of shoes? Carl said.
What's that noise?
Helen said. They listened. Something scratched at the door.
It sounds like Cindy, Jack said. I better let her in.
Well, you're up. Get me a popsicle, Helen said.
She put her head back and laughed.
I'll have another one too, honey, Mary said.
What did I say? I mean Jack, Mary said.
Excuse me.
I thought I was talking to Carl.
Popsicles all around, Jack said. You want a popsicle, Carl?
What?
You want an orange popsicle?
An orange one,
Carl said.
Four popsicles coming up, Jack said.
In a while, he came back with the popsicles and handed them around. He sat down and they heard the scratching again.
I knew I was forgetting something, Jack said.
He got up and opened the front door.
Good Christ, he said. If this isn't something. I guess Cindy went out for dinner tonight. Hey, you guys, look at this.
The cat carried a mouse into the living room, stopped to look at them, then carried the mouse down the hall.
Did you see what I just saw? Mary said. Talk about a bummer.
Jack turned the hall light on. The cat carried the mouse out of the hall and into the bathroom.
She's eating this mouse, Jack said.
I don't think I want her eating a mouse in my bathroom, Helen said. Make her get out of there. Some of the children's things are in there.
She's not going to get out of here, Jack said.
What about the mouse? Mary said.
What the hell? Jack said. Cindy's got to learn to hunt if we're going to Alaska.
Alaska? Helen said. What's all this about Alaska?
Don't ask me, Jack said. He stood near the bathroom door and watched the cat. Mary and Carl said they're going to Alaska. Cindy's got to learn to hunt.
Mary put her chin in her hands and stared into the hall.
She's eating the mouse, Jack said.
Helen finished the last of the corn chips. I told him I didn't want Cindy eating a mouse in the bathroom. Jack? Helen said.
What?
Make her get out of the bathroom, I said, Helen said.
For Christ's sake, Jack said.
Look, Mary said.
Ugh,
Mary said. The goddamn cat is coming in here, Mary said.
What's she doing? Carl said.
The cat dragged the mouse under the coffee table. She lay down under the table and licked the mouse. She held the mouse in her paws and licked slowly from head to tail.
The cat's high, Jack said.
It gives you the shivers, Mary said.
It's just nature, Jack said.
Look at her eyes, Mary said.
Look at the way she looks at us. She's high, all right.
Jack came over to the sofa and sat beside Mary. Mary inched toward Carl to give Jack room. She rested her hand on Carl's knee. They watched the cat eat the mouse.
Don't you ever feed that cat,
Mary said to Helen. Helen laughed.
You guys ready for another smoke? Jack said.
We have to go,
Carl said.
What's your hurry?
Jack said.
Stay a little longer, Helen said. You don't have to go yet.
Carl stared at Mary, who was staring at Jack. Jack stared at something on the rug near his feet. Helen picked through the M&Ms in her hand.
I like the green ones best, Helen said.
I have to work in the morning, Carl said.
What a bummer he's on, Mary said. You want to hear a bummer, folks? There's a bummer.
Are you coming?
Carl said.
Anybody want a glass of milk? Jack said. We've got some milk out there.
I'm too full of cream soda, Mary said.
There's no more cream soda, Jack said.
Helen laughed. She closed her eyes and then opened them and then laughed again.
We have to go home,
Carl said. In a while he stood up and said,
Did we have coats? I don't think we had coats.
What? I don't think we had coats,
Mary said. She stayed seated.
We better go,
Carl said.
They have to go, Helen said.
Carl put his hands under Mary's shoulders and pulled her up.
Goodbye, you guys, Mary said. She embraced Carl.
I'm so full I can hardly move, Mary said. Helen laughed.
Helen's always finding something to laugh at, Jack said, and Jack grinned. What are you laughing at, Helen?
I don't know. Something Mary said,
Helen said.
What did I say? Mary said.
I can't remember,
Helen said.
We have to go, Carl said.
So long, Jack said. Take it easy.
Mary tried to laugh.
Let's go,
Carl said.
Night, everybody, Jack said. Night, Carl.
Carl heard Jack say very, very slowly. Outside, Mary held Carl's arm and walked with her head down. They moved slowly on the sidewalk. He listened to the scuffing sounds her shoes made. He heard the sharp and separate sound of a dog barking, and above that, a murmuring of very distant traffic. She raised her head.
When we get home, Carl, I want to be fucked, talked to, diverted. Divert me, Carl. I need to be diverted tonight.
She tightened her hold on his arm. He could feel the dampness in that shoe. He unlocked the door and flipped the light.
Come to bed,
she said.
I'm coming, he said.
He went to the kitchen and drank 2 glasses of water. He turned off the living room light and felt his way along the wall into the bedroom.
Carl? She yelled. Carl!
Jesus Christ, it's me, he said.
I'm trying to get the light on.
He found the lamp, and she sat up in bed. Her eyes were bright. He pulled the stem on the alarm and began taking off his clothes. His knees trembled.
Is there anything else to smoke? She said.
We don't have anything, he said.
Then fix me a drink.
We have something to drink. Don't tell me we don't have something to drink, she said.
Just some beer.
They stared at each other.
I'll have a beer, she said.
You really want a beer?
She nodded slowly and chewed her lip. He came back with the beer. She was sitting with his pillow on her lap. He gave her the can of beer and then crawled into bed and pulled the covers up.
I forgot to take my pill, she said.
What?
I forgot my pill.
He got out of bed and brought her the pill. She opened her eyes and he dropped the pill onto her outstretched tongue. She swallowed some beer with the pill and he got back in bed.
Take this. I can't keep my eyes open, she said.
He set the can on the floor and then stayed on his side and stared into the dark hallway. She put her arm over his ribs and her fingers crept across his chest.
What's in Alaska? She said.
He turned on his stomach and eased all the way to his side of the bed. In a moment, she was snoring. Just as he started to turn off the lamp, he thought he saw something in the hall. He kept staring and thought he saw it again. A pair of small eyes. His heart turned. He blinked and kept staring. He leaned over to look for something to throw. He picked up one of his shoes. He sat up straight and held the shoe with both hands. He heard her snoring and set his teeth. He waited. He waited for it to move once more, to make the slightest noise. Night school.
My marriage had just fallen apart. I couldn't find a job. I had another girl, but she wasn't in town. So I was at a bar having a glass of beer, and 2 women were sitting a few stools down, and one of them began to talk to me.
You have a car?
I do, but it's not here, I said. My wife had the car. I was staying at my parents' place. I used their car sometimes, but tonight I was walking. The other woman looked at me. They were both about 40, maybe older.
What'd you ask him?
The other woman said to the first woman.
I said, did he have a car?
So do you have a car?
The second woman said to me. I was telling her, I have a car, but I don't have it with me, I said.
That doesn't do us much good, does it?
She said. The first woman laughed.
We had a brainstorm, and we need a car to go through with it.
Too bad. She turned to the bartender and asked for 2 more beers. I'd been nursing my beer along, and now I drank it off and thought they might buy me a round. They didn't.
What do you do?
The first woman asked me. Right now, nothing, I said. Sometimes when I can, I go to school.
He goes to school,
she said to the other woman.
He's a student. Where do you go to school?
Around, I said.
I told you,
the woman said.
Doesn't he look like a student?
What are they teaching you? The second woman said. Everything, I said.
I mean,
she said.
What do you plan to do? What's your big goal in life? Everybody has a big goal in life.
I raised my empty glass to the bartender. He took it and drew me another beer. I counted out some change, which left me with 30 cents from the $2 I'd started out with a couple of hours ago. She was waiting. Teach school, I said.
He wants to be a teacher, she said.
I sipped my beer. Someone put a coin in the jukebox, and a song that my wife liked began to play. I looked around. Two men near the front were at the shuffleboard. The door was open, and it was dark outside.
We're students, too, you know,
the first woman said.
We go to school. We take a night class,
the other one said.
We take this reading class on Monday nights,
the first woman said.
Why don't you move down here, teacher, so we don't have to yell?
I picked up my beer and my cigarettes and moved down two stools.
That's better,
she said.
Now, did you say you were a student?
Sometimes, yes, but not now, I said.
Where?
State College.
That's right,
she said.
I remember now.
She looked at the other woman.
You ever hear of a teacher over there named Patterson? He teaches adult education classes. He teaches this class we take on Monday nights. You remind me a lot of Patterson.
They looked at each other and laughed.
Don't bother about us,
the first woman said.
It's a private joke. Shall we tell him what we thought about doing, Edith? Shall we?
Edith didn't answer. She took a drink of beer and she narrowed her eyes as she looked at herself, at the three of us, in the mirror behind the bar.
We were thinking, the first woman went on, if we had a car tonight, we'd go over and see him. Patterson. Right, Edith?
Edith laughed to herself. She finished her beer and asked for a round, one for me included. She paid for the beers with a $5 bill.
Patterson likes to take a drink, Edith said. You can say that again,
the other woman said. She turned to me.
We talked about it in class one night. Patterson says he always has wine with his meals and a highball or two before dinner.
What class is this? I said.
This reading class Patterson teaches. Patterson likes to talk about different things.
We're learning to read, Edith said. Can you believe it?
I'd like to read Hemingway and things like that,
the other woman said.
But Patterson has us reading stories like in Reader's Digest.
We take a test every Monday night, Edith said. But Patterson's okay. He wouldn't care if we came over for a highball. Wouldn't be much he could do anyway.
We have something on him. On Patterson,
she said.
We're on the loose tonight,
the other woman said.
But Edith's car is in the garage.
If you had a car now, we'd go over and see him,
Edith said. She looked at me.
You could tell Patterson you wanted to be a teacher. You'd have something in common.
I finished my beer. I hadn't eaten anything all day except some peanuts. It was hard to keep listening and talking.
Let's have three more, please, Jerry,
the first woman said to the bartender. Thank you, I said.
You'd get along with Patterson,
Edith said. So call him, I said. I thought it was just talk.
I wouldn't do that, she said. He could make an excuse. We just show up on his porch. He'll have to let us in.
She sipped her beer.
So let's go,
the first woman said.
What are we waiting for? Where'd you say the car is?
There's a car a few blocks from here, I said. But I don't know.
Do you want to go or don't you?
Edith said.
He said he does,
the first woman said.
We'll get a six-pack to take with us.
I only have 30 cents, I said.
Who needs your goddamn money?
Edith said.
We need your goddamn car.
Jerry, let's have three more, and a six-pack to go. Here's to Patterson,
the first woman said when the beer came.
To Patterson and his highballs.
He'll drop his cookies,
Edith said.
Drink up,
the first woman said. On the sidewalk, we headed south, away from town. I walked between the two women. It was about 10 o'clock. I could drink one of those beers now, I said.
Help yourself, Edith said.
She opened the sack and I reached in and tore a can loose.
We think he's home, Edith said.
Patterson, the other woman said. We don't know for sure, but we think so.
How much farther?
Edith said. I stopped, raised the beer, and drained half the can. The next block, I said. I'm staying with my parents. It's their place.
I guess there's nothing wrong with it, Edith said. But I'd say you're kind of old for that.
That's not polite, Edith,
the other woman said.
Well, that's the way I am, Edith said. You'll have to get used to it, that's all. That's the way I am.
That's the way she is,
the other woman said. I finished the beer and tossed the can into some weeds.
Now how far?
Edith said. This is it, right here. I'll try and get the car key, I said.
Well, hurry up, Edith said.
We'll wait outside,
the other woman said.
Jesus,
Edith said. I unlocked the door and went downstairs. My father was in his pajamas watching television. It was warm in the apartment, and I leaned against the jamb for a minute and ran a hand over my eyes. I had a couple of beers, I said. What are you watching?
John Wayne, he said. It's pretty good. Sit down and watch it. Your mother hasn't come in yet.
My mother worked the swing shift at Paul's, a Hofbräu restaurant. My father didn't have a job. He used to work in the woods and then he got hurt. He'd had a settlement, but most of that was gone now. I asked him for a loan of $200 when my wife left me, but he refused. He had tears in his eyes when he said no and said he hoped I wouldn't hold it against him. I'd said it was all right. I wouldn't hold it against him. I knew he was going to say no this time, too. But I sat down on the other end of the couch and said, I met a couple of women who asked me if I'd give them a ride home.
What'd you tell them?
He said. They're waiting for me upstairs, I said.
Just let them wait,
he said.
Somebody'll come along. You don't want to get mixed up with that.
He shook his head.
You really didn't show them where we live, did you? They're not really upstairs.
He moved on the couch and looked again at the television.
Anyway, your mother took the keys with her.
He nodded slowly, still looking at the television. That's okay, I said. I don't need the car. I'm not going anywhere. I got up and looked into the hallway where I slept on a cot. There was an ashtray, a Lux clock, and a few old paperbacks on a table beside the cot. I usually went to bed at midnight and read until the lines of print went fuzzy and I fell asleep with the light on and the book in my hands. In one of the paperbacks I was reading, there was something I remembered telling my wife. It made a terrific impression on me. There's a man who has a nightmare, and in the nightmare he dreams he's dreaming and wakes to see a man standing at his bedroom window. The dreamer is so terrified he can't move, can hardly breathe. The man at the window stares into the room, then begins to pry off the screen. The dreamer can't move. He'd like to scream, but he can't get his breath. But the moon appears from behind a cloud, and the dreamer in the nightmare recognizes the man outside. It is his best friend. The best friend of the dreamer, but no one the man having the nightmare knows. Telling it to my wife, I'd felt the blood come to my face and my scalp prickle. But she wasn't interested.
That's only writing, she said. Being betrayed by somebody in your own family, there's a real nightmare for you.
I could hear them shaking outside the door. I could hear footsteps on the sidewalk over my window.
God damn that bastard,
I heard Edith say. I went into the bathroom for a long time, and then I went upstairs and let myself out. It was cooler, and I did up the zipper on my jacket. I started walking to Paul's. If I got there before my mother went off duty, I would have a turkey sandwich. After that, I would go to Kirby's newsstand and look through the magazines. Then I could go to the apartment to bed and read the books until I read enough, and I slept. The women, they weren't there when I left, and they wouldn't be there when I got back.
Collectors.
I was out of work, but any day I expected to hear from up north. I lay on the sofa and listened to the rain. Now and then I'd lift up and look through the curtain for the mailman. There was no one on the street, nothing. I hadn't been down again 5 minutes when I heard someone walk onto the porch, wait, and then knock. I lay still. I knew it wasn't the mailman. I knew his steps. You can't be too careful if you're out of work and you get notices in the mail or else pushed under your door. They come around wanting to talk, too, especially if you don't have a telephone. The knock sounded again, louder, a bad sign. I eased up and tried to see onto the porch. But whoever was there was standing against the door, another bad sign. I knew the floor creaked, so there was no chance of slipping into the other room and looking out that window. Another knock, and I said, "Who's there?"
"This is Aubrey Bell," a man said. "Are you Mr. Slater?"
"What is it you want?" I called from the sofa.
"I have something for Mrs. Slater. She's won something. Is Mrs. Slater home?"
"Mrs. Slater doesn't live here," I said.
"Well, then, are you Mr. Slater?"
the man said.
"Mr. Slater,"
and the man sneezed. I got off the sofa. I unlocked the door and opened it a little. He was an old guy, fat and bulky under his raincoat. Water ran off the coat and dripped onto the big suitcase contraption thing he carried. He grinned and set down the big case. He put out his hand.
"Aubrey Bell," he said.
"I don't know you," I said.
"Mrs. Slater," he began. "Mrs. Slater filled out a card."
He took cards from an inside pocket and shuffled them a minute.
"Mrs. Slater,"
he read.
255 South 6th East. Mrs. Slater is a winner."
He took off his hat and nodded solemnly, slapped the hat against his coat as if that were it. Everything had been settled, the drive finished, the railhead reached. He waited. "Mrs. Slater doesn't live here," I said. "What did she win?"
"I have to show you," he said. "May I come in?"
"I don't know. If it won't take long," I said. "I'm pretty busy."
"Fine," he said. "I'll just slide out of this coat first. And the galoshes. Wouldn't want to track up your carpet. I see you do have a carpet, Mr.—"
His eyes had lighted and then dimmed at the sight of the carpet. He shuddered. Then he took off his coat. He shook it out and hung it by the collar over the doorknob.
"That's a good place for it," he said.
"Damn weather, anyway." He bent over and unfastened his galoshes. He set his case inside the room. He stepped out of the galoshes and into the room in a pair of slippers. I closed the door. He saw me staring at the slippers and said,
"W.H. Auden wore slippers all through China on his first visit there. Never took them off. Corns."
I shrugged. I took one more look down the street for the mailman and shut the door again. Aubrey Bell stared at the carpet. He pulled his lips. Then he laughed. He laughed and shook his head. "What's so funny?" I said.
"Nothing. Lord," he said.
He laughed again.
"I think I'm losing my mind. I think I have a fever."
He reached a hand to his forehead. His hair was matted and there was a ring around his scalp where the hat had been.
"Do I feel hot to you?"
he said.
"I don't know. I think I might have a fever."
He was still staring at the carpet.
"Do you have any aspirin?"
"What's the matter with you?" I said. "I hope you're not getting sick on me.
I've got things I have to do. He shook his head. He sat down on the sofa. He stirred at the carpet with his slippered foot. I went to the kitchen, rinsed a cup, shook two aspirin out of a bottle. Here, I said. Then I think you ought to leave.
Are you speaking for Mrs. Slater?
He hissed.
No, no. Forget I said that. Forget I said that.
He wiped his face. He swallowed the aspirin. His eyes skipped around the bare room. Then he leaned forward with some effort and unsnapped the buckles on his case. The case flopped open, revealing compartments filled with an array of hoses, brushes, shiny pipes, and some kind of heavy-looking blue thing mounted on little wheels. He stared at these things as if surprised. Quietly, in a churchly voice, he said,
"Do you know what this is?"
I moved closer. I'd say it was a vacuum cleaner. I'm not in the market, I said. No way am I in the market for a vacuum cleaner.
I want to show you something, he said.
He took a card out of his jacket pocket.
Look at this, he said.
He handed me the card.
Nobody said you were in the market, but look at the signature. Is that Mrs. Slater's signature or not?
I looked at the card. I held it up to the light. I turned it over, but the other side was blank. So what? I said.
Mrs. Slater's card was pulled at random out of a basket of cards, hundreds of cards, just like this little card. She has won a free vacuuming and carpet shampoo. Mrs. Slater is a winner. No strings. I am here even to do your mattress, Mr. You'll be surprised to see what can collect in a mattress over the months, over the years. Every day, every night of our lives, we're leaving little bits of ourselves, flakes of this and that, behind. Where do they go, these bits and pieces of ourselves? Right through the sheets and into the mattress, that's where. Pillows too, it's all the same.
He had been removing lengths of the shiny pipe and joining the parts together. Now he inserted the fitted pipes into the hose. He was on his knees, grunting. He attached some sort of scoop to the hose and lifted out the blue thing with wheels. He let me examine the filter he intended to use.
"Do you have a car?"
he asked. "No car," I said. "I don't have a car. If I had a car, I would drive you someplace."
"Too bad," he said. "This little vacuum comes equipped with a 60-foot extension cord. If you had a car, you could wheel this little vacuum right up to your car door and vacuum the plush carpeting and the luxurious reclining seats as well. You would be surprised how much of us gets lost, how much of us gathers in those fine seats over the years."
"Mr. Bell," I said, "I think you better pack up your things and go. I say this without any malice whatsoever." But he was looking around the room for a plug-in. He found one at the end of the sofa. The machine rattled as if there were a marble inside. Anyway, something loose inside. Then settled to a hum.
Rilke lived in one castle after another all of his adult life. "Benefactors," he said loudly over the hum of the vacuum. "He seldom rode in motor cars. He preferred trains. Then look at Voltaire at Siri with Madame Châtelet. His death mask. Such serenity."
He raised his right hand as if I were about to disagree.
"No, no, it isn't right, is it? Don't say it. But who knows?"
With that, he turned and began to pull the vacuum into the other room. There was a bed, a window. The covers were heaped on the floor. One pillow, one sheet over the mattress. He slipped the case from the pillow and then quickly stripped the sheet from the mattress. He stared at the mattress and gave me a look out of the corner of his eye. I went to the kitchen and got the chair. I sat down in the doorway and watched. First, he tested the suction by putting the scoop against the palm of his hand. He bent and turned a dial on the vacuum.
"You have to turn it up full strength for a job like this one," he said. He checked the suction again, then extended the hose to the head of the bed and began to move the scoop down the mattress. The scoop tugged at the mattress. The vacuum whirred louder. He made 3 passes over the mattress, then switched off the machine. He pressed a lever and the lid popped open. He took out the filter.
This filter is just for demonstration purposes. In normal use, all of this material would go into your bag, here, he said.
He pinched some of the dusty stuff between his fingers. There must have been a cup of it. He had this look to his face. It's not my mattress, I said. I leaned forward in the chair and tried to show an interest.
Now the pillow, he said.
He put the used filter on the sill and looked out the window for a minute. He turned.
I want you to hold on to this end of the pillow, he said.
I got up and took hold of 2 corners of the pillow. I felt I was holding something by the ears. Like this, I said. He nodded. He went into the other room and came back with another filter. How much do those things cost? I said.
Next to nothing, he said. They're only made out of paper and a little bit of plastic. Couldn't cost much.
He kicked on the vacuum, and I held tight as the scoop sank into the pillow and moved down its length. Once, twice, 3 times. He switched off the vacuum, removed the filter, and held it up without a word. He put it on the sill beside the other filter. Then he opened the closet door. He looked inside, but there was only a box of Mouse Begone. I heard steps on the porch. The mail slot opened and clinked shut. We looked at each other. He pulled on the vacuum and I followed him into the other room. We looked at the letter lying face down on the carpet near the front door. I started toward the letter, turned and said, "What else? It's getting late. This carpet's not worth fooling with. It's only a 12x15 cotton carpet with no skid backing from Rug City. It's not worth fooling with."
"Do you have a full ashtray?"
he said.
"Or a potted plant or something like that? A handful of dirt would be fine."
I found the ashtray. He took it, dumped the contents onto the carpet, ground the ashes and cigarettes under his slipper. He got down on his knees again and inserted a new filter. He took off his jacket and threw it onto the sofa. He was sweating under the arms. Fat hung over his belt. He twisted off the scoop and attached another device to the hose. He adjusted his dial. He kicked on the machine and began to move back and forth over the worn carpet. Twice I started for the letter. But he seemed to anticipate me, cut me off, so to speak, with his hose and his pipes and his sweeping and his sweeping. I took the chair back to the kitchen and sat there and watched him work. After a time, he shut off the machine, opened the lid, and silently brought me the filter, alive with dust, hair, small, grainy things. I looked at the filter, and then I got up and put it in the garbage. He worked steadily now. No more explanations. He came out to the kitchen with a bottle that held a few ounces of green liquid. He put the bottle under the tap and filled it. "You know I can't pay anything," I said. "I couldn't pay you a dollar if my life depended on it. You're going to have to write me off as a dead loss, that's all. You're wasting your time on me," I said. I wanted it out in the open, no misunderstanding. He went about his business. He put another attachment on the hose, in some complicated way hooked his bottle to the new attachment. He moved slowly over the carpet, now and then releasing little streams of emerald, moving the brush back and forth over the carpet, working up patches of foam. I had said all that was on my mind. I sat on the chair in the kitchen, relaxed now, and watched him work. Once in a while, I looked out the window at the rain. It had begun to get dark. He switched off the vacuum. He was in a corner near the front door. "You want coffee?" I said. He was breathing hard. He wiped his face.
I put on water, and by the time it had boiled and I'd fixed up two cups, he'd had everything dismantled and back in the case. Then he picked up the letter. He read the name on the letter and looked closely at the return address. He folded the letter in half and put it in his hip pocket. I kept watching him. That's all I did. The coffee began to cool.
"It's for a Mr. Slater," he said.
"I'll see to it," he said. "Maybe I will skip the coffee. I better not walk across this carpet. I just shampooed it." "That's true," I said. Then I said, "You're sure that's who the letter's for?" He reached to the sofa for his jacket, put it on, and opened the front door. It was still raining. He stepped into his galoshes, fastened them, and then pulled on the raincoat and looked back inside.
"You want to see it," he said. "You don't believe me."
"It just seems strange," I said.
"Well, I'd better be off," he said.
But he kept standing there.
"You want the vacuum or not?"
I looked at the big case, closed now and ready to move on. "No," I said. "I guess not. I'm going to be leaving here soon. It would just be in the way."
"All right,"
he said, and he shut the door. What do you do in San Francisco?
This has nothing to do with me. It's about a young couple with three children who moved into a house on my route the first of last summer. I got to thinking about them again when I picked up last Sunday's newspaper and found a picture of a young man who'd been arrested down in San Francisco for killing his wife and her boyfriend with a baseball bat. It wasn't the same man, of course, though there was a likeness because of the beard. But the situation was close enough to get me thinking. Henry Robinson is the name. I'm a postman, a federal civil servant, and have been since 1947. I've lived in the West all my life, except for a 3-year stint in the Army during the war. I've been divorced 20 years, have two children I haven't seen in almost that long. I'm not a frivolous man, nor am I, in my opinion, a serious man. It's my belief a man has to be a little of both these days. I believe, too, in the value of work. The harder, the better. A man who isn't working has got too much time on his hands. Too much time to dwell on himself and his problems. I'm convinced that was partly the trouble with the young man who lived here. His not working. But I'd lay that at her doorstep, too. The woman. She encouraged it. Beatniks, I guess you'd have called them if you'd seen them. The man wore a pointed brown beard on his chin and looked like he needed to sit down to a good dinner and a cigar afterwards. The woman was attractive, with her long dark hair and her fair complexion. There's no getting around that. But put me down for saying she wasn't a good wife and mother. She was a painter. The young man, I don't know what he did. Probably something along the same line. Neither of them worked. But they paid their rent and got by somehow, at least for the summer. The first time I saw them was around 11:15, a Saturday morning. I was about 2/3 through my route when I pulled onto their block and noticed a 56 Ford sedan pulled up in the yard with a big open U-Haul behind. There were only three houses on Pine, and theirs was the last house, the others being the Murchisons, who'd been in Arcata a little less than a year, and the Grants, who'd been here about 2 years. Murchison worked at Simpson Redwood, and Jean Grant was a cook on the morning shift at Denny's. Those two, then a vacant lot, then the house on the end that used to belong to the Coles. The young man was out in the yard behind the trailer, and she was just coming out the front door with a cigarette in her mouth, wearing a tight pair of white jeans and a man's white undershirt. She stopped when she saw me, and she stood watching me come down the walk.
I slowed up when I came even with their box and nodded in her direction. "Getting settled all right?" I asked.
"It'll be a little while,"
she said, and moved a handful of hair away from her forehead while she continued to smoke. "That's good," I said. "Welcome to Arcata." I felt a little awkward after saying it. I don't know why, but I always found myself feeling awkward the few times I was around this woman. It was one of the things helped turn me against her from the first. She gave me a thin smile, and I started to move on when the young man, Marston was his name, came around from behind the trailer carrying a big carton of toys. Now, Arcata is not a small town, and it's not a big town, though I guess you'd have to say it's more on the small side. It's not the end of the world, Arcata, by any means, but most of the people who live here work either in the lumber mills or have something to do with the fishing industry, or else work in one of the downtown stores. People here aren't used to seeing men wear beards, or men who don't work, for that matter. "Hello," I said. I put out my hand when he set the carton down on the front fender. "The name's Henry Robinson. You folks just arrived?"
"Yesterday afternoon," he said.
"Some trip. It took us 14 hours just to come from San Francisco."
The woman spoke up from the porch.
"Pulling that damn trailer."
"My, my," I said and shook my head. "San Francisco. I was just down in San Francisco, let me see, last April or March."
"You were you?"
she said.
"What did you do in San Francisco?"
"Oh, nothing really. I go down about once or twice a year, out to Fisherman's Wharf to see the Giants play. That's about all." There was a little pause, and Marston examined something in the grass with his toe. I started to move on. The kids picked that moment to come flying out the door, yelling and tearing for the end of the porch. When that screen door banged open, I thought Marston was going to jump out of his skin. But she just stood there with her arms crossed, cool as a cucumber, and never batted an eye. He didn't look good at all. Quick, jerky little movements every time he made to do something. And his eyes, they'd land on you and then slip off somewhere else, then land on you again. There were three kids, two little curly-headed girls about 4 or 5, and a little bit of a boy tagging after. "Cute kids," I said. "Well, I got to get underway. You might want to change the name on the box."
"Sure," he said. "Sure, I'll see about it in a day or two. But we don't expect to get any mail for a while yet, in any case."
"You never know," I said. "You never know what'll turn up in this old mail pouch. Wouldn't hurt to be prepared." I started to go. "By the way, if you're looking for a job in the mills, I can tell you who to see at Simpson Redwood. A friend of mine's a foreman there. He'd probably have something." I tapered off, seeing how they didn't look interested.
"No, thanks," he said.
"He's not looking for a job,"
she put in. "Well, goodbye then."
"So long,"
Marston said. Not another word from her. That was on a Saturday, as I said, the day before Memorial Day. We took Monday as a holiday, and I wasn't by there again until Tuesday. I can't say I was surprised to see the U-Haul still there in the front yard, but it did surprise me to see he still hadn't unloaded it. I'd say about a quarter of the stuff had made its way to the front porch. A covered chair and a chrome kitchen chair and a big carton of clothes that had the flaps pulled off the top. Another quarter must have gotten inside the house, and the rest of the stuff was still in the trailer. The kids were carrying little sticks and hammering on the sides of the trailer as they climbed in and out over the tailgate. Their mama and daddy were nowheres to be seen. On Thursday, I saw him out in the yard again and reminded him about changing the name on the box.
"That's something I've got to get around to doing," he said.
"Takes time," I said. "There's lots of things to take care of when you're moving into a new place." People that lived here, the Coles, just moved out 2 days before you came. He was going to work in Eureka, with the Fish and Game Department. Marston stroked his beard and looked off as if thinking of something else. I'll be seeing you, I said.
So long, he said.
Well, the long and the short of it was he never did change the name on the box. I'd come along a bit later with a piece of mail for that address, and he'd say something like,
Marston? Yes, that's for us, Marston. I'll have to change the name on that box one of these days. I'll get myself a can of paint and just paint over that other name. Cole.
All the time his eyes drifting here and there. Then he'd look at me, kind of out of the corners, and bob his chin once or twice. But he never did change the name on the box, and after a time I shrugged and forgot about it. You hear rumors. At different times I heard that he was an ex-con on parole who come to Arcata to get out of the unhealthy San Francisco environment. According to this story, the woman was his wife, but none of the kids belonged to him. Another story was that he had committed a crime and was hiding out here. But not many people subscribed to that. He just didn't look the sort who'd do something really criminal. The story most folks seemed to believe, at least the one that got around most, was the most horrible. The woman was a dope addict, so this story went, and the husband had brought her up here to help her get rid of the habit. As evidence, the fact of Sally Wilson's visit was always brought up. Sally Wilson from the Welcome Wagon. She dropped in on them one afternoon and said later that, no lie, there was something funny about them, the woman particular. One minute the woman would be sitting and listening to Sally run on, all ears it seemed, and the next she'd get up while Sally was still talking and start to work on her painting as if Sally wasn't there. Also, the way she'd be fondling and kissing the kids, then suddenly start screeching at them for no apparent reason. Well, just the way her eyes looked if you came up close to her, Sally said. But Sally Wilson has been snooping and prying for years under cover of the Welcome Wagon. You don't know, I'd say when someone would bring it up. Who can say? If he'd just go to work now. All the same, the way it looked to me was that they had their fair share of trouble down there in San Francisco, whatever was the nature of the trouble, and they decided to get clear away from it. Though why they ever picked Arcata to settle in, it's hard to say, since they surely didn't come looking for work. The first few weeks, there was no mail to speak of, just a few circulars from Sears and Western Auto and the like. Then a few letters began to come in, maybe one or two a week. Sometimes I'd see one or the other of them out around the house when I came by, and sometimes not. But the kids were always there, running in and out of the house or playing in the vacant lot next door. Of course, it wasn't a model home to begin with, but after they'd been there a while, the weeds sprouted up and what grass there was yellowed and died. You hate to see something like that. I understand old man Jessup came out once or twice to get them to turn the water on, but they claimed they couldn't buy hose, so he left them a hose. Then I noticed the kids playing with it over in the field, and that was the end of that. Twice I saw a little white sports car in front, a car that hadn't come from around here. One time only I had anything to do with the woman direct. There was a letter with 5 cents postage due, and I went up to the door with it. One of the little girls let me in and ran off to fetch her mama. The place was cluttered with odds and ends of old furniture and with clothing tossed just anywhere. But it wasn't what you'd call dirty. Not tidy, maybe, but not dirty either. An old couch and chair stood along one wall in the living room. Under the window was a bookcase made out of bricks and boards, crammed full of little paperback books. In the corner there was a stack of paintings with their faces turned away, and to one side another painting stood on an easel covered over with a sheet. I shifted my mail pouch and stood my ground, but starting to wish I'd paid the nickel myself. I eyed the easel as I waited, about to sidle over and raise the sheet when I heard steps.
What can I do for you?
She said, appearing in the hallway and not at all friendly. I touched the brim of my cap and said, A letter here with 5 cents postage due, if you don't mind.
Let me see. Who's it from?
Why, it's from Jer, that kook, sending us a letter without a stamp. Lee?
She called out.
Here's a letter from Jerry.
Marston came in, but he didn't look too happy. I leaned on first one leg, then the other, waiting.
5 cents,
she said.
I'll pay it, seeing as it's from old Jerry. Here. Now goodbye.
Things went on in this fashion, which is to say no fashion at all. I won't say the people hereabouts got used to them. They weren't the sort you'd ever really get used to. But after a bit, no one seemed to pay them much mind anymore. People might stare at his beard if they met him pushing the grocery cart in Safeway, but that's about all. You didn't hear any more stories. Then one day, they disappeared. In 2 different directions. I found out later she'd taken off the week before with somebody, a man. And that after a few days he'd taken the kids to his mother's over to Reading. For 6 days running, from one Thursday to the following Wednesday, their mail stayed in the box. The shades were all pulled, and nobody knew for certain whether or not they'd lit out for good. But that Wednesday, I noticed the Ford parked in the yard again, all the shades still down, but the mail gone. Beginning the next day, he was out there at the box every day waiting for me to hand over the mail, or else he was sitting on the porch steps smoking a cigarette, waiting, it was plain to see. When he saw me coming, he'd stand up, brush the seat of his trousers, and walk over by the box. If it happened that I had any mail for him, I'd see him start scanning the return addresses even before I could get it handed over. We seldom exchanged a word, just nodded at each other if our eyes happened to meet, which wasn't often. He was suffering, though, anybody could see that, and I wanted to help the boy somehow if I could. But I didn't know what to say exactly. It was one morning a week or so after his return that I saw him walking up and down in front of the box with his hands in his back pockets, and I made up my mind to say something. What, I didn't know yet, but I was going to say something, sure. His back was to me as I came up the walk. When I got to him, he suddenly turned on me, and there was such a look on his face. It froze the words in my mouth. I stopped in my tracks with his article of mail. He took a couple of steps toward me, and I handed it over without a peep. He stared at it as if dumbfounded.
Occupant, he said.
It was a circular from L.A. advertising a hospital insurance plan. I'd dropped off at least 75 that morning. He folded it in 2 and went back to the house. Next day he was out there, same as always. He had his old look to his face, seemed more in control of himself than the day before. This time I had a hunch I had what it was he'd been waiting for. I'd looked at it down at the station that morning when I was arranging the mail into packets. It was a plain white envelope addressed in a woman's curly-cue handwriting that took up most of the space. It had a Portland postmark, and the return address showed the initials J.D. and a Portland street address. Morning, I said, offering the letter. He took it from me without a word and went absolutely pale. He tottered a minute and then started back for the house, holding the letter up to the light. I called out, She's no good, boy. I could tell that the minute I saw her. Why don't you forget her? Why don't you go to work and forget her? What have you got against work? It was work day and night, work that gave me oblivion when I was in your shoes, and there was a war on where I was. After that, he didn't wait outside for me anymore, and he was only there another 5 days. I'd catch a glimpse of him, though, each day, waiting for me just the same, but standing behind the window and looking out at me through the curtain. He wouldn't come out until I'd gone by, and then I'd hear the screen door. If I looked back, he'd seem to be in no hurry at all to reach the box. The last time I saw him, he was standing at the window and looked calm and rested. The curtains were down, all the shades were raised, and I figured at the time he was getting his things together to leave. But I could tell by the look on his face he wasn't watching for me this time. He was staring past me, over me, you might say, over the rooftops and the trees south. He just kept staring even after I'd come even with the house and moved on down the sidewalk. I looked back. I could see him still there at the window. The feeling was so strong I had to turn around and look for myself in the same direction he was. But, as you might guess, I didn't see anything except the same old timber, mountains, sky. The next day he was gone. He didn't leave any forwarding. Sometimes mail of some kind or other shows up for him or his wife, or for the both of them. If it's first class, we hold it a day, then send it back to where it came from. There isn't much. And I don't mind. It's all work. One way or the other, and I'm always glad to have it.
The student's wife. He had been reading to her from Rilke, a poet he admired, when she fell asleep with her head on his pillow. He liked reading aloud, and he read well, a confident, sonorous voice, now pitched low and somber, now rising, now thrilling. He never looked away from the page when he read, and stopped only to reach to the nightstand for a cigarette. It was a rich voice that spilled her into a dream of caravans just setting out from walled cities and bearded men in robes. She had listened to him for a few minutes, then she had closed her eyes and drifted off. He went on reading aloud. The children had been asleep for hours, and outside a car rubbered by now and then on the wet pavement. After a while, he put down the book and turned in the bed to reach for the lamp. She opened her eyes suddenly, as if frightened, and blinked two or three times. Her eyelids looked oddly dark and fleshy to him as they flicked up and down over her fixed, glassy eyes. He stared at her.
"Are you dreaming?"
he asked. She nodded and brought her hand up and touched her fingers to the plastic curlers at each side of her head. Tomorrow would be Friday, her day for all the 4 to 7-year-olds in the Woodlawn apartments. He kept looking at her, leaning on his elbow, at the same time trying to straighten the spread with his free hand. She had a smooth-skinned face with prominent cheekbones. The cheekbones, she sometimes insisted to friends, were from her father, who had been 1/4 Nez Perce. Then, "Make me a little sandwich of something, Mike, with butter and lettuce and salt on the bread." He did nothing, and he said nothing because he wanted to go to sleep. But when he opened his eyes, she was still awake, watching him.
"Can't you go to sleep, Nan?"
he said very solemnly.
"It's late."
"I'd like something to eat first," she said. "My legs and arms hurt for some reason, and I'm hungry." He groaned extravagantly as he rolled out of bed. He fixed her the sandwich and brought it in on a saucer. She sat up in bed and smiled when he came into the bedroom, then slipped a pillow behind her back as she took the saucer. He thought she looked like a hospital patient in her white nightgown. "What a funny little dream I had."
"What were you dreaming?"
he said, getting into bed and turning over onto his side away from her. He stared at the nightstand, waiting. Then he closed his eyes slowly. "Do you really want to hear it?" she said.
"Sure," he said.
She settled back comfortably on the pillow and picked a crumb from her lip. "Well, it seemed like a real long, drawn-out kind of dream, you know, with all kinds of relationships going on. But I can't remember everything now. It was all very clear when I woke up, but it's beginning to fade now. How long have I been asleep, Mike?
It doesn't really matter, I guess. Anyway, I think it was that we were staying someplace overnight. I don't know where the kids were, but it was just the two of us at some little hotel or something. It was on some lake that wasn't familiar. There was another older couple there, and they wanted to take us for a ride in their motorboat. She laughed, remembering, and leaned forward off the pillow. The next thing I recall is we were down at the boat landing. Only the way it turned out, they had just one seat in the boat, a kind of bench up in the front, and it was only big enough for three. You and I started arguing about who was going to sacrifice and sit all cooped up in the back. You said you were, and I said I was, but I finally squeezed in the back of the boat. It was so narrow it hurt my legs, and I was afraid the water was going to come in over the sides. Then I woke up.
That's some dream,
he managed to say, and felt drowsily that he should say something more.
You remember Bonnie Travis, Fred Travis' wife? She used to have color dreams, she said.
She looked at the sandwich in her hand and took a bite. When she had swallowed, she ran her tongue in behind her lips and balanced the saucer on her lap as she reached behind and plumped up the pillow. Then she smiled and leaned back against the pillow again. Do you remember that time we stayed overnight on the Tilton River, Mike? When you caught that big fish the next morning? She placed her hand on his shoulder. Do you remember that? She said.
She did.
After scarcely thinking about it these last years, it had begun coming back to her lately. It was a month or two after they'd married and gone away for a weekend. They had sat by a little campfire that night, a watermelon in the snow-cold river, and she'd fried spam and eggs and canned beans for supper and pancakes and spam and eggs in the same blackened pan the next morning. She had burned the pan both times she cooked, and they could never get the coffee to boil, but it was one of the best times they'd ever had. She remembered he had read to her that night as well. Elizabeth Browning and a few poems from the Rubaiyat. They had had so many covers over them that she could hardly turn her feet under all the weight. The next morning, he had hooked a big trout, and people stopped their cars on the road across the river to watch him play it in. Well, do you remember or not? She said, patting him on the shoulder. Mike?
I remember, he said.
He shifted a little on his side, opened his eyes. He did not remember very well, he thought. What he did remember was very carefully combed hair and loud, half-baked ideas about life and art, and he did not want to remember that.
That was a long time ago, Nan, he said.
We just got out of high school. You hadn't started to college, she said. He waited, and then he raised up onto his arm and turned his head to look at her over his shoulder.
You about finished with that sandwich, Nan?
She was still sitting up in the bed. She nodded and gave him the saucer.
I'll turn off the light, he said.
If you want, she said. Then he pulled down into the bed again and extended his foot until it touched against hers. He lay still for a minute and then tried to relax. Mike, you're not asleep, are you?
No, he said. Nothing like that.
Well, don't go to sleep before me, she said. I don't want to be awake by myself. He didn't answer, but he inched a little closer to her on his side. When she put her arm over him and planted her hand flat against his chest, he took her fingers and squeezed them lightly. But in moments, his hand dropped away to the bed and he sighed. Mike? Honey? I wish you'd rub my legs. My legs hurt, she said.
God, he said softly. I was sound asleep.
Well, I wish you'd rub my legs and talk to me. My shoulders hurt too, but my legs especially. He turned over and began rubbing her legs, then fell asleep again with his hand on her hip. Mike?
What is it, Nan? Tell me what it is.
I wish you'd rub me all over, she said, turning onto her back. My legs and arms both hurt tonight. She raised her knees to make a tower with the covers. He opened his eyes briefly in the dark and then shut them.
Growing pains, huh?
Oh, God, yes, she said, wiggling her toes, glad she had drawn him out. When I was 10 or 11 years old, I was as big then as I am now. You should have seen me. I grew so fast in those days, my legs and arms hurt me all the time. Didn't you?
Didn't I what?
Didn't you ever feel yourself growing?
Not that I remember, he said.
At last, he raised up on his elbows, struck a match, and looked at the clock. He turned his pillow over to the cooler side and lay down again. She said, "You're asleep, Mike. I wish you'd want to talk."
All right, he said, not moving.
Just hold me and get me off to sleep. I can't go to sleep, she said. He turned over and put his arm over her shoulder as she turned onto her side to face the wall. Mike? He tapped his toes against her foot. Why don't you tell me all the things you like and the things you don't like?
Don't know any right now, he said. Tell me if you want, he said.
If you promise to tell me. Is that a promise? He tapped her foot again. Well, she said and turned onto her back, pleased. I like good foods, steaks and hash brown potatoes, things like that. I like good books and magazines, riding on trains at night, and those times I flew in an airplane. She stopped. Of course, none of this is in order of preference. I'd have to think about it if it was in the order of preference. But I like that, flying in airplanes. There's a moment as you leave the ground, you feel whatever happens is all right. She put her leg across his ankle. I like staying up late at night and then staying in bed the next morning. I wish we could do that all the time, not just once in a while. And I like sex. I like to be touched now and then when I'm not expecting it. I like going to movies and drinking beer with friends afterwards. I like to have friends. I like Janis Hendricks very much.